that was what I was trying to capture with deep liberation, this idea of being supported and moving into our depths and freeing the aspects of ourself that are wanting to be known, that are wanting to be embodied in the world, that are the medicine of our time, for our time, and the unique challenges in our time, just to be free to bring those out into expression.
You're listening to the Feed Your Wild podcast, a conscious lifestyle show about all things nourishing for your body, mind, and soul. I'm Vanessa Rodriguez, and join me for candid conversations with changemakers, exploring health and wellness, food as medicine, intuition and spirituality, and nature-based practices that will transform your health and feed all parts of your wild self. Happy Pisces season, and sending all my love to all you Pisces out there. Love you so much. All your feels and emoting. Today, we have a wonderful conversation with Langston Kahn, author of Deep Liberation, Shamanic Teachings for Reclaiming Wholeness in a Culture of Trauma. And we talk about a lot connected in with navigating the inner realms and emotion. So I felt that this was such a beautiful first interview and podcast episode in this season of Pisces. If you haven't already heard of Langston, I know you're going to love him. I first heard of him through my partner, actually, who was following a center called The Last Mask Center with teacher and author Christina Pratt. Langston was a student of Christina Pratt and now teacher and shamanic healer, guiding beautiful experiences through The Last Mask Center based out of Portland, and also in his own work and practice online. I remember reaching out to Langston quite some time ago because I knew I wanted him on the podcast, and timing wasn't really working out. And then he began writing a book. Well, as divine timing would have it, we came together after the release of this book. And I'm so grateful that this was our first conversation together after having read his book, Deep Liberation. So once again, reminder to myself and others that sometimes when things don't work out as we want to in our own timing, that's because there's something waiting that is way better than what we can imagine. What I really appreciate about Langston and his book is, number one, how eloquent he is, and number two, how inclusive he is energetically and in his languaging. I think there's a lot of really beautiful books and teachings out there on similar topics. However, many older resources are created within a certain context and zeitgeist or culture. And so I believe the rising of these new old voices, so to speak, within the spiritual and shamanic worlds, voices that can represent multicultural lens and colorful experiences, it's really critical right now. So I'm really grateful that we got to have this chat with Langston. In this interview, Langston shares how he came into his shamanic path, and Langston also breaks down the concept of shamanism. We talk about what Langston means by deep liberation and why rediscovering the body and the felt sense is a critical aspect in this process. Langston guides us in unlocking the deep mind and exploring the wilderness of our inner landscape, teasing out the difference between our ego and analytical mind and deep mind, and how to begin to commune and be present with the various parts of ourself so that we can heal deep wounds. Langston shares the concept of the truth cord. In a world where many people believe in various so-called truths and the hijacking of our minds and hearts and intuition, he shares this practice of cultivating the truth cord so that we can reorient ourselves back to our truth. We touch on why in shamanism, beliefs aren't really as important as taking action and how to know what actions to take. We talk about unlocking the power that is held in our triggers and how to begin to engage with your spirit helpers and guides for deeper support. And this is one of the things that I hear very often from clients and students is that they don't feel connected or that they're receiving messages or insights. So Langston sheds some light on this and gives some really amazing tips on how to develop your connection with your spirit helpers. One of my big takeaways is the concept of community as it relates to deep liberation and the importance of prioritizing the receiving of support from not just those in our family and earth-based community, but also from the unseen realms. Langston also shares his heartfelt prayer for his book, Deep Liberation, one that I deeply resonate with and share as we move forth together in these transformative times. Remember that you are never alone. We were born to be here as an answer to a prayer. And I hope that this enlightening conversation brings glimmers of hope and practical tips in your personal journey. And with that, let's get to this talk with Langston Khan. Welcome back, everybody, to Feed Your Wild. Today, we have Langston Khan on the podcast. Langston is a shamanic practitioner and teacher specializing in radical human transformation, ancestral healing, and the restoration of an authentic relationship with our emotions. He stands firmly at the crossroads, his practice informed by somatic modalities, contemporary shamanic traditions, initiations into traditions of the African diaspora, training with indigenous elders, and his helping spirits and ancestors weaving it all together. He gives workshops and lectures globally in person and online, and is the author of Deep Liberation, Shamanic Teachings for Reclaiming Wholeness in a Culture of Trauma. Langston, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's so good to be with you here, Vanessa.
I came across your work, it was quite some time ago, on the Rune Soup podcast. So I don't know how long ago that actually was, but I really appreciated your heart-centered work and perspective in your conversation on Rune and also using shamanic spiritual technologies for challenges that at that time, this was pre-COVID, so challenges that were already bubbling up to be looked at, and I think just really kind of blew up over the past couple of years. And yeah, these transformative times. So I knew that I had to have you on the podcast. And then you released your amazing book, Deep Liberation. So there's a lot of juiciness to dive into here. But I first wanted to ground people into you and in your history and how you came into this work, particularly around the like shamanic traditions and teachings that you describe in your book and that you practice in your own life. So I know it could be a long story, but what are the pearls? Like, when did this start for you and how did you come into this work?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, the more you engage in this type of work, I think the more you see everything being connected and part of that path. But just to choose a place to go into the story with, for me, it really started with leaving college at the height of the recession at that time, around, you know, 2009, and just being really devastated feeling by my lack of an ability to find work that was both meaningful to me and wasn't totally burning me out. And encountering, realizing like after college was over, I had all of these deep emotional issues, like chronic emotional and mental issues that were keeping me in a state of suffering and pain and turbulence inside and in other aspects of my life and my relationships. And then with that, also having really hard to deal with sort of chronic health issues at the time as well that were sending me to the hospital at least 3 times a year often. And the combination of those two things, along with a lot of turbulence that was happening in my family at the time, like, you know, coming back home and actually for the first time really seeing my parents just as other adults in my life versus looking to them as these like parents, as like a kind of like ideal that have to fit a certain role. All of that came crashing together, and it combined with this realization at the time that I've been, you know, I consider myself since maybe like 7th grade in middle school as a witch. You know, in middle school, my friends and I had watched, I don't know, The Craft, and there was like, and everyone was playing Enya CDs at the time, and we were reading like books of shadows online of witch that witches had posted there on like the old wild internet. And we were starting to cast spells, and we were really becoming engaged in witchcraft as a kind of both practice and religion. And that was really wonderful for us at that time to reopen my engagement with magic after sort of forgetting for a lot of my life, because I had been, as a child, one of those kids who's constantly talking to invisible beings. But then as you get older in this culture, and, you know, settler colonialist culture, you're encouraged to kind of devalue and forget those experiences. And so Wicca and witchcraft was a way that I started to refine my ability to engage with the numinous and spirit. But as my friends kind of grew out of that phase, cultural phase, I still found myself identifying that way. But I realized after college, I no longer wanted this to be an identity. I wanted this to be a practice. I wanted it to be an art as seriously as I took, I was in a film at the time. So seriously, as I took my filmmaking, I wanted to take the craft of magic. And so I found a teacher and a coven at the time to work with. And it was this old, what you might call a hard guard, like a Gardnerian witch. So Gardnerian Wicca is one of the sort of founding traditions of Wicca that a lot of other sort of neo-paganism movements or neo-Wiccan movements emerge from. And I found a teacher was very traditional in this practice. And so suddenly, like 3 times a month, I was doing intensive ritual with lots of intense protocol and lots of intense cleansing and opening up certain psychic centers. And suddenly, I think the combination of starting to really focus on the deep inner work I needed to do to move into some of these emotional issues I was having and starting to delve deep into a serious practice of the craft of magic and the art of magic, I think came together to that my helping spirit said, oh, wait, he's paying attention. You know, it's time to like get things moving. It's time. And so I had this dream, this initiatory dream where one of my helping spirits kept landing on my chest and it was covered in these parasites. And I turned to my teacher in the dream and asked if I could tell it to go away because it was full of these like little weird parasites. And my teacher told me, yes, but you have to ask its name first. And so I did ask its name and it gave it to me. And then I woke up and I knew that that wasn't just a normal dream. I remembered every detail so vividly. And I knew I had to investigate this. Like, what's wrong with my helping spirit? Why is it covered in parasites? And when I actually journeyed to that helping spirit, it told me that I was the one that was covered in parasites. And it was just showing that to me. It's a little bit of a trickstery helping spirit. So it was kind of laughing and like calling me an idiot while it was doing it because it felt like, why don't you know, like silly human, that of course I would never have a disease like this. You're the one with the disease that I'm trying to show you have and you need to deal with. And so that led me to pursue some shamanic practitioners to help me with this issue that my helping spirit had showed me in this dream. And as, you know, the first shamanic practitioner just kind of saw this big mass of web-like vines growing out of my root chakra that I had sort of created in different patterns of my life. And they just, all they were able to say is like, you know, this is your stuff. I can pull it out for you if you want. And I was like, okay, I guess. And they did. And my symptoms went away completely for 2 weeks and then came back much, much worse. So then I found another shamanic practitioner who became one of my primary teachers today still. And this is Christina Pratt. And she was able to tell me each layer of those sort of web-like vines that I'd created them instead of having boundaries in each point in my life when I created them and why. And she's able to take them off of me, but say, I can't transform these for you. You need to transform them because you made these choices. And here's how you can transform them over these next months. And that became my sort of spirit boot camp because I was given a very specific ritual prescription that involved learning shamanic skills that were completely new to me at that time and forming a really intimate relationship with the helping spirits that had already been coming into my life in these strange ways, through dreams, through people handing me objects on the street, through suddenly having these visionary experiences and ritual. And it all just came to a head with this quest I needed to go on to actually figure out, what does it feel like to have healthy boundaries, and how do I unmake the choices I learned to survive growing up of not having boundaries? And ultimately, that led me to enter into this 5-year training program and stepping into spiritual adulthood with the Last Mass Center and the Last Mass community. Because in my process of transforming those vines, I realized that no matter how much good work I did, ultimately, I needed a bigger container to hold that transformational process than just the one of an individual, or even an individual and a practitioner. And I needed the container of community, because the wounds that I was transforming had been created in community and in family. And so I needed a container that was bigger than my family to transform and shift them. And so that led me to these teachings that were held in the container of community, and also led me into really devoting a lot of my life to figuring out, how do we work in community as contemporary people in a way that's more in alignment with maybe pre-contact Indigenous understandings of what community is and what it takes to live, for lack of a better word, shamanically within the context of community.
Oh my gosh, that you just touched on so many things here that, like, I feel are so palpable these days, such as boundaries, boundary work. This is one of the things that I continue to hear from listeners, from clients, from friends, and also within my own life. Spiritual initiation, sovereignty and accountability for the self versus wanting that quick fix or wanting a savior to come in and fix us. And then also the transforming of collective shadows, that we have the power to really tap into that. There's so much here that I think it can get really complex for people when they start to think about, like, what does it mean to truly heal and tend to these aspects of myself and my soul wellness? And I think that maybe we can start with what you mean by deep liberation, you know, the title of your book. There's a lot of things that come up for me when I hear deep liberation, those words, but I'd love to hear from you, like, what is the core essence of deep liberation? And then we can begin to unpack that.
Mm-hmm. For me, the core essence of deep liberation is realizing that the times that I have felt most free have not been when I was alone somewhere. Like, you know, we get sort of fed these images of the rugged individual out on, like, a cliffside with a wind in their hair, you know, feeling free. And, like, that becomes like the stock image that means freedom. But for me, my actual experience of moments of practicing freedom in my life have happened most when I'm in community, when I am supported in community with people. Specific word. I don't just mean people gathered together or people who share an identity. I mean people who have a shared vision they're working to manifest together, and commitments to each other that they're making in the process of manifesting that vision that they're agreeing to try to live by together or live into together, and shared skills and practices that allow them to live into those commitments. And so when I've had that experience of being in that kind of community and feeling how that vision that I'm trying to manifest, that's bigger than me, that's bigger than any one individual, is pulling out of me parts of myself I didn't even know existed. And then I'm risking trying to bring these new shy parts of me out in service to this vision alongside others, and having others reflect back to me when I'm going sideways and really off with what I'm trying to do, or when I'm actually doing something that's amazing, but I don't even know because it's so natural to me. That's when I have felt most free. It, being supported in community in that process of diving deep within to our innermost essence, to the sort of chaos of the unknown of our soul, and bringing into embodiment parts of ourself that we haven't yet experienced in service to this vision that's bigger than ourselves, and seeing how my actions in service to that vision have heart and meaning for me and have an impact on those around me and potentially on the world. And that is when I feel most free. And so for me, that was what I was trying to capture with deep liberation, this idea of being supported and moving into our depths and freeing the aspects of ourself that are wanting to be known, that are wanting to be embodied in the world, that are the medicine of our time, for our time, and the unique challenges in our time, just to be free to bring those out into expression.
That's so beautiful. You know, and I'm also feeling from maybe those listening in, because I tend to feel a little bit of the pulse, you know, and reverberating within me is this sense of grief of not having community, like this, and almost like, oh my gosh, well, I don't have community. Like, how am I going to access deep liberation? And how does that even begin for me if I don't feel like I'm tapped into a community? And like, even just the concept of community in modern times, like, what does community within this context of deep liberation look like?
That is such a good question. So yes, first, I didn't start this work in community, the work that I would call the work of deep liberation. And I think one thing that's helpful to remember is, yes, I do believe that community is ultimately necessary to create anything that's actually going to change the systems we're inhabiting, because individuals can't really change systems. And in a sense, none of us are really free until all of us are free. But with that, we ourselves are communities. You know, from a shamanic perspective, we're kind of like a flock of birds that come together for a lifetime to live a specific vision that is that unique energy of our purpose that has never been seen on the earth before, that is unique to this lifetime. So you can sort of take what I was saying about community, and also part of the practice of deep liberation to me is learning, how do we bring that compassion to ourself that I was talking about community holding for me? How do we hold the parts of ourselves that have been exiled, the parts of ourselves that have been marginalized, the parts of ourselves that have been judged unfairly? How do we hold them in our compassion and curiosity and allow them to emerge within us from those depths, and then sit with them without trying to change them, without trying to fix them, just be with them and try to see them exactly as they are, understanding that, of course, when we're really able to be with any part of us exactly as it is, without trying to fix or change it or shift it, then it's free to move. It's free to shift. It's free to begin to move back into the living process that we are.
This sort of takes me to this point in your book when you talk about the deep mind. And you so eloquently lay out very practical steps for people to begin this process of exploration. And I think you call it, you know, the wilderness of the inner landscape. What is the deep mind, and how do we begin to unlock the deep mind? Because I feel a lot of people might bring so much of the, we could call the analytical mind to this process, you know, like, how do I do it? When? Why? Like, all of these questions. Why is this happening to me? So how do we tease out that difference between ego and analytical mind, and then this deep mind in this process?
Yeah, I think you can talk about it theoretically, but it's so much of it is a feeling. And I think how I would characterize that feeling, the difference between the analytical mind and the deep mind, is the analytical mind sort of thinks there's something to figure out, that something that it needs to know before it can take action. Or it sort of thinks it already has things figured out. Like, I know about my issues with my dad, or I know about that thing that happened to me that one time. Like, I don't need to look at that. I don't need to risk like bringing all that back up, because I know all about that already. There's this feeling of like, I know enough from the analytical mind. And when new information then comes in, there's this effort of the analytical mind to sort of sift through it and quickly sort it into categories of information that we already know and have, or stories we already know and have. So in a sense, the analytical mind dominates. It dominates the wisdom of our emotions and our heart and thinks it knows better than them. It wants to try to sort of, maybe sometimes even in a kind of paternal way, care for and sort of tell what to do our emotional wisdom body and our heart. Whereas the deep mind, what I call the deep mind, is that capacity for the heart to rise up and the mind to be held by it, in a sense. That feeling of being able to track with compassionate curiosity what our heart and our emotions are revealing to us without trying to make sense of them instantly. There's often a feeling when we're in the deep mind of a sense of uncertainty, of being inarticulate, of not being able to quite find the right words, of having almost like you're like stumbling through the dark with your hands out, trying to feel your way to something. And in that willingness and that capacity of the deep mind to stand in the discomfort of the unknown versus trying to analyze and compartmentalize and put everything into its right place, we can then give birth to new wisdom. Because when we don't come in thinking we already know everything or we need to quickly figure everything out to be safe, if we can cultivate the capacity of the deep mind to be with the unknown as an ally, then we can move to the edge of what we currently know and allow new wisdom to emerge, which often means new parts of us that maybe haven't felt safe in that piercing light of the analytical mind to make themselves known, to emerge and communicate with us and share with us maybe longings and desires that we weren't even aware were operating underneath the surface waiting to be discovered by us.
Yeah, but what you're talking about with these different parts of ourselves, I have a friend, her name is Nola. She's an elder in my community. She's a retired hypnotherapist. She calls it a parts party. You have a party with your different parts. But I'm curious if perhaps you can offer up for those listening, it's like, where do we even start? Like, this all sounds amazing. And I want to begin to explore this landscape within myself in a safe way. What's the first place to really look at, or how does one begin this exploration in that safe way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of different ways to begin depending on where people are at in their process. For some of us, if we've spent a lot of our life learning to survive through dissociating from our body, which is sometimes a necessity when you've experienced certain types of trauma, that's how we get through it, then the first step is going to be figuring out, how do I get back into my body, or how do I allow myself to have my experience of being in my body connected to the earth be my habit versus like the rare instance every now and then. And so the first step might just be working with different ways to begin to even work with your breath, like a really simple way, just working with your breath to feel the weight of your body being supported by whatever you're sitting on, and then to feel the air on your skin, and then to take a few deep breaths into each of the different sort of main energy centers of your body, into your head, your throat, your heart, your solar plexus, your belly, your pelvis, your root. And then from there, just begin to sit in that internal awareness of your body, maybe even starting with your heart. And I like to sometimes guide people into that space of their heart, just to stand there and feel in that space of their heart, what does that landscape feel like to you right now in this moment? If you really sort of turn up your imaginal capacity and open all of your senses, sense of sound, sense of smell, visuals, kinesthetic feelings in your body, your intuitive knowing, and just sort of turn all of that up and notice, what does it feel like to stand in the landscape of my heart? What's there right now? What kind of ecosystem does it look like? And orienting to a practice of describing versus labeling, not trying to say like, oh, this is this and this means that, like the analytical mind, but really being in that quality of feeling in the dark, or of things emerging from the fog, of just describing as best you can the qualities of your experience versus what you think that means, or inventing a story about that experience. And then from there, seeing if you can really orient with an attitude that you might approach a, you know, shy animal that you wanted to approach you with. That sense of openness and neutrality and care that you might try to express with your body to a shy animal you wanted to approach you, approaching your own heart like that shy animal and just seeing what it wants to share with you in this moment.
This is reminding me of a part where you talk about presence and presence as a muscle. Because, you know, I think when you're describing that so beautifully, by the way, thank you for that offering. I think about even my own practice and how I almost constantly have to remind myself, you know, I have a meditation practice. I do spiritual work, like I'm doing intuitive readings every day. So through that work, I have to ground, I have to do these energetic practices, but really staying present for what is for me in my body takes reminders and work. And so I appreciate that, and that you do offer at this practice as just that, a practice that we have to work at.
Absolutely. I think sometimes we tend to think of our authentic self as something we have to go and find somewhere, or something we have to like go to a workshop to discover, you know, or, and in my experience, it's much more of our authenticity is much more of a muscle that we can practice cultivating all the time and practice strengthening all the time through that willingness to be present with our own experience and give voice to it.
And I think it's through that presence too that then that's really only way that we're able to tap into the truths of ourselves. And I really appreciate a practice and a concept that you offer in your book, the concept of the truth cord and cultivating that truth cord. I think that's incredibly important as it relates to our current times where there's a lot of information and misinformation in the ethers, accessible through our fingertips. There's a lot of arguments back and forth over a variety of things. And, you know, I think we're seeing this more and more that it makes one wonder, like, what even is the truth? And how do I connect to what is true for me? Would you be able to touch in on the truth cord concept?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And so this is a concept that's a tool that was created by Christina Press, part of the teachings of the cycle of transformation. And this tool is a union of our three main centers of knowing truth with the energies of the above and the below, like the sky and the earth, those two sort of centers of the universe, in a sense, of our own experience as a human being with a body on this earth. And so we're taking the inspiration of our mind, that which sort of pulls us on the path of our vision, the intuition of our heart, those like longings and desires and yearnings and feelings of moving towards something. And then the instinct of our gut, that kind of primal yes or no. And we're bringing them together because the inspiration can be very easily hijacked. We're seeing that all the time in our culture, just like you were talking about with all the sort of hijacking of truth, people getting hijacked into conspiracy theories. And one of the ways, the easiest ways to see that you've been hijacked in your inspiration center is you think you're following one vision, like you're on the path of social justice. And then when you look behind you at your wake, you're leaving a trail of injustice in your wake. And so you're generating the opposite of what the vision that you have. And then similar, when our heart center, our intuitive knowing gets hijacked, there's this sense of, yes, I'm following my heart. Finally, I'm moving on the path of my heart. But we're finding ourselves being pulled more and more off of our center and becoming more and more ungrounded, more and more unsure in a bad way. Like not the beautiful uncertainty of being in the unknown, but this sense of just like, wow, I feel less and less like I have a deep connection to myself the more I follow what I think is my heart pulling me on this direction. And we are following our heart, but that sort of intuitive knowing has been hijacked. And so then there's the instinct is sort of like the hardest center to hijack, that primal sort of gut yes or no response to something. But it can sometimes be hijacked if we've experienced certain types of trauma, like certain types of sexual trauma that can sort of cut us off from that sort of lower half of our body or causes a defense mechanism to have to cut ourselves off from those parts of us. And so when we bring these three centers of knowing together, they're already harder to hijack and more powerful because they're informing each other in their awareness. They're not operating in silos. And then we also connect them to the sky and the earth. So we're bringing in this deep wisdom of the earth and of manifestation, and this deep wisdom of the cosmos and our interconnection and the heavens, and bringing those two truths together, so that are slightly bigger than our personal truth. So we can begin to notice with our truth cord truth, whether or not it's resonating in the presence of truth, regardless of the source of that truth, regardless of if we like the source of that truth, regardless if we like that truth, but just feeling on this primal level, does this resonate with my truth core? Does this resonate with my personal sense of truth, my personal relationship with truth? And if so, then how does that change how I'm showing up in this moment? Or how does that change my understanding and perception of my reality currently?
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking too, as you're saying, like, if you find that you don't like it, but even though it's the truth, or you're feeling it to be the truth, and how during this process, you can be triggered. Mm-hmm. And yet there's the power held in our triggers. Could you speak into that? Because I think it's a very common experience, especially now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the first things I might say around that is that in Indigenous cultures, pretty universally, we find this honoring of mystery. It's like this very white supremacist, settler colonialist concept that mystery needs to be conquered. Like, you know, that the hero has to go out and slay the unknown monster or the strange being at the bottom of the sea or whatever, and then everything can be right with the world because there's no more mystery. We've conquered it. In Indigenous cultures, this understanding that if something is mysterious, something is unknown, if something is strange, that probably means it's pretty sacred and pretty important. And so there's this honoring. So one answer is, I think it helps make us less likely to be triggered by a truth we don't like when we understand that mystery is to be honored, and we can try changing our habit of feeling unsafe in the presence of the unknown or mystery. And instead saying, oh, here's a mystery. That's interesting. There's something sacred here. How can I approach this sacred thing in a good way? In terms of triggers, how I think of triggers, our body and our soul and our life kind of conspiring to bring into our awareness parts of us that are stuck in old choices we made to survive as a child, that weren't in alignment with our authenticity and our true nature. And so there was this energy that was sort of trying to move through our heart, in a sense, into expression, and instead it went sideways because we felt like we were going to die if we didn't make that choice. And for a child, that can be lots of things that make us feel like we're going to die. It could be, I might not be loved. And for a child dependent on their parents, not being loved could equal death. It could be abandonment. It could be being isolated. It could be being banished, you know, or exiled, or actual death, you know, from different types of abuse. But these different experiences we have can make us think, as when we're younger, okay, if I don't make this choice, I'm going to die. So I better make this choice, even though it's not quite in alignment with who I truly am and how my heart's actually wanting to move me into action in this moment. And they're perfectly good choices because they get us here. They allow us to survive. But then parts of us get stuck making those same choices again and again and again. And whenever we're encountering similar situations in our present life, sort of projecting them onto our present experience. And so in my understanding of how I approach triggers is that triggers are these moments, these sort of repeating patterns that keep triggering us in the same way, are often these moments that our life and our soul are trying to bring into our awareness so we can rescue those parts of us trapped in those moments we made a choice to survive and reclaim the power that's stuck in those old choices. And that's another part of the deep liberation, you know, going back and liberating these parts of us that are imprisoned in these old memories and choices and stories from the past.
You know, I'm reminded of this one part where you mentioned how in shamanism, and I might be misquoting you, but how beliefs don't matter as much as action. And I think when we start to move through these processes or protocols, and we face our triggers, and, you know, we might be confronted with things that are outside of our sphere of belief, that it really is that compassionate curiosity that you were speaking into earlier, plus taking action, that really moves the needle, so to speak. Do you have more insight on that? Because I think it's really common for the belief thing to hold people back, and that could be a major hangup or impediment to actually taking action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there can be a way often that our hearts kind of shut down or close, and we get caught in this addiction to the need to know in our head. Like, I have to know this before I can take this action. When the only way we could actually know that thing we think we need to know is through our embodied action, and then experiencing what that feels like and how the world responds to that action. And so, yeah, in shamanism, what I meant when I said belief isn't as important is that shamanism is not a religion. It's not a belief system. It's not a faith. Because what shamanism is ultimately, small as shamanism, talking about this cross-cultural definition of shamanism, not specific to, you know, the Tungus Manchu people's shamanism, which I would call big as shamanism. This cross-cultural shamanism holds this understanding that it is created from people just observing over thousands of years what works, what actually works sustainably for humans to stay over thousands of years in right relationship with each other, with their environment, with the invisible world, with themselves, with their communities. You know, how do we do this? How do we stay in a state of balance and wholeness and be in our true role as human beings, as an integral part of all of life, that is in service of all of life, not just not taking too much, but actually helping all of life to thrive proactively through our presence as part of that vast organism of the earth. And so that's what I mean when I say belief is less important. It's not about what you believe. It's about what you do, how the stories you hold cause you to act, and whether or not those actions and the stories are in service of life or not. And so, yeah, sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was just nodding my head and in agreement.
Yeah, so I think I got a little lost there. What was the question there?
Well, you answered it, because I was really asking, how can we break down this idea that beliefs aren't necessarily as important as taking action within shamanism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think for me, there's an understanding that spiritual information for the sake of information is not useful in shamanic cultures. And I think especially in our culture right now, when we are fed with so much information all the time that it's overwhelming, you know, we're constantly reading things, scrolling through feeds, having information pumped into us practically, we don't need just more information. We need to understand that any information you receive, whether it be from your emotions or from spirit, in a shamanic context, you're responsible to take action for. So if you receive a dream, you need to act on that dream, even if it just means taking that dream to your shrine or altar, or however you personally engage in your own intimate relationship with your helping spirits or spirit in general, and taking that dream and saying, you know, I had this dream. I don't really know how to take action on it because I feel really unclear about what it means. Could you send me another dream, or could you send me experiences throughout my day that will help me to understand the message from this dream? And that being an action too, you know, that can be just to ask again, it can be an action, but we're responsible for taking action based on our relationship with spirit. Because if we're not, then we're never getting the feedback from the living world of if our action we took based on our interpretation of that message actually was accurate. So if we're not doing that, we're not in this process of constantly fine-tuning our relationship and intimacy with our spirit. And so then we're often going off sideways or living in our bubbles, illusion or delusion.
I want to get into this idea of engaging with our spirit helpers and guides in this process, because that's probably one of the most common things I hear from clients and students and listeners, is that like in this process, they want to engage in this process. Maybe they've done, you know, some intuitive work, or they're doing, you know, they're being present with themselves, they're grounding, and yet they feel disconnected from their guides, their spirit helpers. What have you seen to be helpful in these instances for people who are just like, I just feel like I'm not connected, I'm not getting any messages?
Yeah, I think it is a craft, a skill, engaging with spirit. And I think sometimes because of the ways that we're taught to devalue the imagination and devalue spirit in much of contemporary Western culture, there can be a way that we expect that either, you know, we're going to have a spiritual experience, our gifts are going to come wildly online and everything's going to make perfect sense, or we're just never going to have any experience at all. There's like no in between. There's just like super clear, like a movie expectation in relationship with spirit, or if anything else happens, then it means nothing's happening. So I think the first step is letting go of our expectations of what communication with spirit is like if we haven't had that experience yet, or if we're not aware that we've had that experience yet. And I think this is where teachers can be really helpful and community can be really helpful in forging that relationship so we can see other people's experiences and share and engage in process together and have that reflection of our own gifts and engagement and relationship. But then some of the beginning ways that I think are really helpful to starting to forge that relationship is actually forging a relationship with your own symbolic language in your body. And that's certainly for me how I learned to connect with spirit again after I'd kind of lost that ability from years of traditional education, in a sense. And for me, where it started was learning concrete skills to be with the felt sense in my body, this knowing beyond words that we carry, that we can invite our body to bring into our awareness, then find the best words that we can to describe. It's like I was talking about in that experience of feeling in the dark. That kind of work of almost like playing a game of hot and cold, like feeling the felt sense in our body and then giving voice to it, like finding the best word we can to describe it, and then taking that word back to the feeling in our body and noticing, does that feeling open up in response to that word we just used? Does it kind of close down in response to the word, and then trying to find a better word if it's sort of shying away? And then feeling when we find just the right word, there's sort of shifting and opening and more is revealed. If we could begin to engage in that process, that language of our inner symbolic language is the exact same language that our helping spirits use to communicate with us and that our dreams use to communicate with us. So I think often when we're struggling with connecting with spirit, the first step is to work to connect to our own spirit through our body.
I think that's so helpful. And I also see how, you know, like when I'm doing readings, so much of what I'm relaying, the person, the querent who's receiving the reading is like, oh, like I had a dream about that. Or, oh yeah, that's been popping up for me, you know? And it's like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, well then you've been getting the message, you know? It's like, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. now your guides are sending it through me to give it to you to sort of like paste like a giant finger pointing at like, hey, this was us trying to speak to you. So mm-hmm. yeah, I appreciate you walking us through that, because I think that sometimes, you know, people might want some sort of really like fantastical, elaborate experience with a connection with their spirit guides, when in actuality it could feel really mundane.
Yeah, I call that the neon pink buffalo expectation. Like, waiting for that beautiful neon pink buffalo to emerge to the horizon. You know?
Totally.
And it's totally natural. You know, that's how I started wanting that. And when I started trying to do shamanic journeying, I just saw blackness. I saw nothingness. That was for so long. That was my experience. So I have such sympathy for people that are in that place in their process. And I just really encourage you to keep exploring and keep troubling the expectations you have of what your experience should be like, and trusting that, just as you beautifully said, Vanessa, you know, that spirit is already communicating with you in a million ways in your life. If we can just sort of get out of our own way to listen and open, that, like, you know, 9 times out of 10, when I tell a client, a helping spirit that I've retrieved on their behalf during a healing session, they already have a stuffed animal or a poster or a picture, a little figurine of that somewhere in their life already. You know, or they had one as a child. And it's like, it's amazing how I think it's important to realize that it takes huge amounts of force and, you know, military strength and money and power and control to actually keep us from a relationship with spirit, because from a shamanic perspective, that's our birthright. Every human being on earth has helping spirits that are meant to walk with them and remind them of that unique energy that they are here to bring and help them to choose consciously how they are bringing that energy into the world. And so it can be really disheartening trying to remember and reclaim these traditions in a culture that so devalues them. But I think it's important to remember that this culture puts so much time and effort and energy into disconnecting us from that experience. And that's because it's so natural.
Mm-hmm. I'm feeling that so deeply. And I feel that a lot of people listening, it's almost like we could take a pause and just take a breath and release some of the expectations and, you know, that we hold for our experience and sort of like high level of expectation of what we should be doing or experiencing in this process of this deep liberation work, I think, that you're talking about. You know, Langston, we're running out of time and there's so much more that I have, but I think what I really would love to create space for right now for sort of all of us listening collectively to hold is, what is your prayer for this book that you birthed and the message that and the beautiful tools that you are putting out there through this book? I just want to create space to honor that and for you to maybe share what's in your heart about what your prayer is for this book.
Thank you. Right now, we're living in a time when there's so much divisiveness and so many old stories rearing their heads back up, you know, stories of white supremacy, stories of Nazism, stories of, you know, all sorts of hideous cultural wounding that are asking for us to actually look at them again and get to the roots and not to try to plaster over right behavior, you know, like the appearance of right behavior or right language over them, but actually look at the roots of these cultural illnesses and work with those wounds at the root. And I think we can only do that, you know, we can only do that if we're willing to look at the roots of our own wounds as part of that process. I'm not saying instead of, we can absolutely be a beautiful, engaged organizer, activist, spiritual leader, or just mom or dad or, you know, teacher, whatever role you have, we can do our life's work and we can simultaneously be working to see where do we carry in ourselves the stories that these cultural illnesses are rooted in, that cause us to be complicit in these cultural illnesses, and work to reclaim and rescue our power from those stories and let the story leave our body and no longer hold them inside of us, to no longer cut off the parts of us that our culture has told us to. And so my prayer for this book is that it helps give people the foundational tools that can help them to do that work, that can help people to cultivate the resilience to eventually not just engage in their own healing process, but begin to move into some of these fractures in our culture and weave greater wholeness there. And to begin to cultivate the resilience necessary to be able to gather in community, in groups that are devoted to weaving that kind of wholeness and practicing freedom together. And in doing so, create a new culture. In doing so, being able to tell a new story for the people with our lives that is rooted in true love, in that force of the universe that fiercely and compassionately is always trying to remind us who we are and what we came here to do. And to be able to do that as a collective, not just for individuals, but for humanity, to remember as humanity the beauty and power and, you know, life-giving force we are meant to be on this planet versus where we actually are, to become the people who can actually bridge that gap. So it's a big prayer, but that is honestly my prayer for this book, that it can land with people who are interested in that kind of work and help them to deepen wherever they are on their own personal path of that process.
Ooh, amen, aho, and so it is.
So it is, yes.
Oh, Lex, that was so beautiful. I just feel my heart is so expanded with that prayer. So I know we're holding it, receiving that. And my last question for you, Langston, is what is feeding your wild, whether that's body, mind, spirit right now?
Oh, wow. I love this question. So what's feeding my wild right now actually is boxing. It's so opposed to like a lot of my identity of like who I am in the world, but it's been such heart medicine for me to start boxing actually. And yeah, I'm just doing private sessions, wearing a mask with an instructor, but, it's been really healing my relationship with my center and my ability to move into force and penetration when necessary from my center, that sort of cultivating that deep yin field of foundation and feeling that power rise up from the earth through my feet, through my hips, that then comes out of my hands, and feeling safe in that expression of that power. Because for me, for a lot of my life, I had a real distrust of that kind of power because I had seen so many, mostly men in my life abuse that power. And so reclaiming that power and seeing how it's teaching me to deepen my connection to the earth has been a real gift right now in my life and helped me to reclaim a new part of my wild.
Love it. Oh yeah, I'm feeling that one. And I think all of us could use like a good punching session.
Totally. Yeah, that too. Like just get it all out. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. Well, I would love for everyone to tune more into your work. And so where's the best way to find you and your work online?
Yeah, so people can, if they want to work with me, they can go to my website, langstonkahn.com, langstonkahn.com. And I also, so two of the ways I work is through one-on-one coaching sessions and also shamanic healing work. And then I also teach online courses. And primarily I teach through Last Mass Center Online currently. And so you can find links to those classes on my website as well. And there's actually a class coming up that people might find interesting that I'm not teaching, but I'm supporting. And I highly recommend. It's called the ShadowTransformationProtocol.com. You can find it. And it's a lot about learning skills to rescue the parts of ourselves that have been most tossed away, locked away and the key thrown away and kind of unfairly judged. And so they've grown twisted and monstrous over time as they're forced to watch our life from the sidelines, and learning how we can sort of crack the code of that cell where they've been kept and rescue them and then transform them into the allies they were always meant to be in our life.
I actually went to your and Christina's webinar on this, shadow work. Mm-hmm. And it was so powerful, the experience I had. By a miracle, I was by myself because I have family visiting. So that's not the case for the majority of my life the past week. And I was able to go deep with this and had a pretty profound experience that was a guide that reappeared to me in connection with this process. But I highly recommend for people to check it out because I think it weaves so beautifully with a lot of what you were touching in on today, especially as it relates to the work that we can start doing on ourselves with our shadows and then beyond into the collective shadows. So
absolutely. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Oh yeah. And I was just saying people can also, connect with me in the usual social networks, Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. I'm there as well. And so, yeah, I'm happy to connect with people wherever they find me.
Perfect. Well, of course, I will have all the links in the show notes. And Langston, thank you so much for your your prayer, but also the gifts that you are bringing through this book. And I highly recommend folks check it out because you make it so practical and you have real protocols in here that people can follow step by step. And I think that having that sort of structure can be really helpful for people in navigating these realms, which can feel a bit numinous, you know. And so I appreciate that and I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. It's really wonderful to talk with you.
Hey there, I made something for you. One of the biggest challenges that I hear from people is that they are feeling stuck when it comes to their health. You're a smart, capable, and creative change maker, right? And you know what you should be doing for your health. So what gives? Well, it's not about willpower. And I wanted to create something that would help you to unlearn the things that are keeping you stuck so that you can get out of your own way and master the mindset of health. That's why I created Wildly Unstuck, where you'll learn the top 5 things that I have found to sabotage your health goals and what to do about them. You'll learn what it really takes to become committed and unstoppable when it comes to your health goals and find the clarity you've been looking for so you know exactly what to do to get back into alignment. And I made it totally free. So if this is something that you want to dive into and create a vision and soul goals for your health and your life and bring your gifts to the world because we know that we need it, then I invite you to join us in Wildly Unstuck. You can find that at wildlyrooted.com/unstuck. I'll see you on the other side.